Welcome back to Case of the Sunday Scaries. I'm Elise.
And I'm Annie.
And holy buckets, I am a little sleepy today. It was my birthday weekend, which probably you're thinking, oh, that means she went out, she had a good time, she's recovering. No, I just worked all weekend. So
that is the epitome of just as we get older. Remember back in the day whenever we used to celebrate our birthdays so hard, we'd go out like Wednesday through Sunday and still feel amazing and feel fantastic for that Monday. But yeah, now it's like if we can do one day, we're doing well. But no, that's funny that you had to work though.
I tell you what, you're talking about getting older and birthdays changing. I bought myself a birthday gift, and the minute I clicked purchase, I went, holy crap, I'm officially old, because
what
I got excited over buying myself a new mattress.
Oh, man.
In my defense, my mattress since moving to Denver is Blake's hand-me-down whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It has had a lot bigger bodies on it than me, and I'm not being rude. I'm just talking about Blake is like 6'3". He's a big dude. So I kind of have this crevice in the mattress that is wildly uncomfortable.
Your back's getting a little older, needs some more firmness to it.
Yes. So I needed to get a new mattress, but I really thought to myself, okay, I planned this like Sunday fun day, which I promptly canceled, bought myself a new mattress. Yeah, this is 30s. This is 30s.
I love this for you. Honestly, ideal. Not being hungover, making the most of today. We're recording. You see how our focus and priorities shift as we get older.
Speaking of recording, I am really excited for this because this was a case voted on by the Scary Squad.
Yeah, we posted on our Instagram a poll between cruise ship deaths or realtor incidents. And I know people are probably thinking, how did she manage to pull realtors into a true crime podcast? But a few episodes ago, I was doing some research and I started noticing how many cold cases involved realtors, specifically realtors on the scene of an open house or a showing. Not just realtors in everyday life. And it got my mind spinning. The seed was planted and I have not been able to drop the topic since. So I'm really glad that our Scary Squad voted on this one. But full disclosure, I will also be doing a cruise ship death one.
I figured you would. And in true you and me fashion, this was supposed to be a mini bonus episode.
Mm-hmm.
She has 14 pages of research.
I could not stop. I actually had to reel it in. Like, I'm going to lose the audience at some point. So I picked three cases that really stood out to me. One is pretty well known. The other two were completely new to me, which is why I go down these rabbit holes. Elise, you're the same. If we don't know anything about them, I have like 14 tabs open of research. And I'm like, okay, I got to stop at some point.
Yeah, I put my Mac to good use while researching these cases. And I know you're the same. So 14 pages, let's...
This episode is over realtors who have been kidnapped or murdered specifically while showing houses. Elise, the more I do research with this podcast, the more I realize that no one is really safe out there. We all need to be vigilant and aware, but I do want to clarify that this episode is not to scare anyone from becoming a realtor or any realtors out there. I have friends who are realtors. My sister-in-law also is one. So I want everyone to stay safe. I'll list some tips at the beginning and the end. And in the show notes, I'll also link off to the National Association of Realtor website. They have a lot of really great tips and videos and guidelines. The truth is, we probably all know a realtor. From the outside, this career path seems safe. There's no dangerous chemicals. There's no crazy machinery or unsafe working conditions. But despite outward appearances, real estate agents face a very specific type of danger, humans. According to a 2018 National Association of Realtor Safety report, 33% of its members said they feared their personal safety at some point that year.
That's a third.
Again, to give some context, in 2018, there were 1.3 million members. I'm not good at math, but 33% is around 430,000 realtors who are part of this organization feared their safety at some point in 2018 alone.
Yeah, that should not be the case.
It's high, right? I was like, am I just thinking that's high because I'm making this episode? But I do feel like that's a lot of people. A different survey said that 40% of the NAR, which is the National Association of Realtors, have felt unsafe during a showing, and 43% of NAR members carry a weapon of some sort during showings, pepper spray to tasers to even firearms.
Well, yeah, I guess it makes sense if you're going to be potentially alone with someone.
With strangers. I do think the NAR does a great job about, like I said, posting these guidelines, posting tips, empowering their members to really feel safe. But what makes this career so dangerous goes back to my first point, humans. realtors are going to these showings alone, usually with strangers they had never met before, and they usually cannot control where these properties are. They could be in the middle of the country or in an unsafe part of town. The other reason is because realtors rely on public advertising to drive traffic to open houses or to gain new clients. So they are putting their names out there, their pictures out there, and it's to no fault of their own. That's just the business of being a realtor.
Right. It's marketing. And you know, now that you said that, I'm thinking about it. And I probably have a little different viewpoint just because being on The Bachelor and mm-hmm. you learn pretty quickly afterwards how to make yourself a little bit more private as far as showing addresses online, all of that. But my friends that are real estate agents are constantly posting their open houses of where they're going to be, and they're posting it to social media. And I never really thought in the same context of that's not maybe not your home address, but you're telling people on what date and what time exactly where you're going to be. And that's potentially just as dangerous, like you're saying.
Yeah, this was eye-opening to me as well. The first case we are talking about today is probably one of the most well-known cases when it comes to realtor deaths. This case happened in Canada, and it's the unsolved murder of Lindsay Buziak. This murder happened back in 2008 in a suburb of Victoria, British Columbia. Because I'm doing three, I'm not going to go super in depth, but I am going to do my best to give a lot of detail and to really do these people justice. Lindsay was 24 years old with a promising career ahead of her. She was described by family and friends as being ambitious, caring, and determined. Her boyfriend of 18 months, named Jason Zalo, was, and still is, part of a prominent and wealthy family that owns a successful real estate business that is still in business today. Lindsay worked for a RE/MAX office, and Jason's mom, Shirley, was actually the manager. So it was kind of this full circle of working and having a relationship, but it all coming together during her work life.
They're keeping it all in the family.
Exactly. In late January 2008, Lindsay received a call from a woman who told her that she and her husband were looking for a home to buy. They wanted a 3-bedroom, 3-bathroom house with a large master bedroom, and they also wanted a separate living area for their housekeeper. The best part? This caller had a budget of $1 million and wanted the house in 3 days. Kind of a realtor's dream, right? They have a budget, they have a sense of urgency, and Lindsay is kind of this junior realtor who thinks this is the opportunity of a lifetime. The caller had a foreign accent and used what later turned out to be a fake name. Lindsay was a little bit unnerved by the nature of this call. She asked the caller how she had gotten her personal cell phone number, as, like I said, she was relatively junior employee to RE/MAX. The caller said that a previous client of Lindsay's had passed it on to her. This is really common in the real estate world, as referrals are very valuable.
Yeah, it's all about networking. Mm-hmm.
Lindsay asked around and couldn't really find a client that gave her number away, which just added to her hesitancy around this client. So Lindsay is torn. The client seems great. Not only does she have deep pockets, but she has a sense of urgency, but she isn't sure what to do because she feels like something is off. Let's call it a woman's instinct, which we know is one of the most powerful things about being a woman.
Oh, intuition. Mm-hmm. It's always right.
Yep, always. Even when we don't want it to be. Gotta trust that. She spoke with her boyfriend, Jason, and her father, Jeff, about the call, and she revealed her concerns. Jason encouraged Lindsay to take on the client because of the high commission. He went on to promise her that he'd be outside of the property in his car in case anything went wrong. The thought of commission and the knowledge that Jason would be right outside was encouraging to Lindsay, and she took the clients on. Lindsay found a really great property in the upscale neighborhood of Gordon Head and made an appointment with the client to view it at 5:30 p.m. on Saturday, February 2nd, 2008. The second rolls around, and Lindsay grabbed a late lunch with Jason, her boyfriend. They cashed out at 4:24, and they left in their own separate vehicles. Lindsay went home to change, and Jason went on to an auto shop to pick up a colleague. Because of this detour, Jason was running a little bit behind. The auto shop captured him and the colleague leaving at 5:30 exactly, which was the time that he was supposed to be outside the house, making Lindsay feel a little bit safer. He texted her, let her know he's running behind, but he would be there. Meanwhile, at the house, witnesses report seeing a couple meet with Lindsay outside of the home. Even though the client told Lindsay she would be alone, she did end up bringing her quote-unquote husband with her, which I'm sure only added to Lindsay's kind of nervousness around this. The witnesses saw Lindsay shake the couple's hands, and according to the witness, her body language looked as if she had never met them before. They were complete strangers. The three of them enter the house, and the showing begins. 10 minutes later, around 5:40, Jason and his colleague showed up to the house and saw a figure inside. Now, Jason didn't really want to come across as that nosy boyfriend.
It's like a fine line between being protective and being viewed as controlling.
Exactly.
Perhaps. And he's doing it on her behalf. But it's not like you can walk up to this couple and be like, hi, my girlfriend was scared of you, so I'll just be right outside. Yeah, that's not going to go over well with potential clients.
For sure. Lindsay's 24. She wants to come across as confident. She's a little nervous. But yeah, Jason's kind of trying to respect her professionally. He drove around the back of the neighborhood and he sat there for a little bit with his colleague in the car. Another 10 minutes passed and he sends Lindsay a text asking her if she's okay. Sadly, she never even opened up that text. Another 20 minutes passed with no response, so Jason started to get a little bit worried. He went to the front door and found it locked when he tried to open it. He peeked inside and saw Lindsay's shoes in the entrance hall, but there was no sign of movement and no one had answered his repeated frantic knocks on the door. At this point, Jason called 911. While he was on the line with the operator, his colleague went around the backside of the house and found a gap in the fence in the back garden. He entered the garden and saw that the back patio door was wide open. He called out to Jason, who told the 911 operator that they were going inside. He then hung up the phone. Once they were inside, Jason runs around the house looking for Lindsay, and he finds her lying in a pool of blood in the master bedroom. He frantically calls 911 again and tells them he needs an ambulance.
Can I interrupt you really quick? Because you're pointing out something I didn't know. Or maybe I did and just forgot this detail. So his colleague, is this a work colleague or just a friend of his?
A work colleague.
Okay. And they are not the ones that were the eyewitness to seeing this couple because they arrived late.
Exactly. It actually kind of happened to be fate that people even saw the couple meeting Lindsay because this was kind of a quiet neighborhood. And all the sources I read were just like, they happened to see this couple meeting Lindsay and get a really good description. But yeah, Jason and the colleague are not the witnesses. The ambulance arrived and so did law enforcement. They take Lindsay away to the hospital to try and save her, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen. And they also take Jason and his colleague into custody. The two were released without charge after their version of events was verified with the timestamp surveillance footage from the auto shop. It was very clear that they were not there. They could not have committed the murders because they're not the couple. I think one of the thoughts was maybe they were dressed up as a couple, but whenever you have timestamps, you have a solid alibi. You can't be in two places at once. So back at the crime scene, this case just gets more bizarre. There was not a single piece of physical evidence, no fingerprints, and no DNA on the scene. Remember, this scene is pretty bloody, so it's kind of hard to determine, but they couldn't pick out two pieces of DNA, only Lindsay's.
And it just also shocks me how quick this must have all happened, considering the boyfriend and his buddy show up not extraordinarily late.
Nope.
They're waiting outside. They don't hear anything, no screams or nothing. And then two, not only do you have to overcome Lindsay and follow through with this murder, but then to not have any evidence, how did they clean it up? Maybe not clean up the blood, but clean up any, you know, little hairs that dropped out of their
exactly.
Head.
I'm glad you brought up the timeline because Lindsay met them at 5:30. Police believe, according to her body, at 5:41, this murder happened. What's wild is at 5:41, her phone actually pocket dialed someone who heard like muffling. There was no voices. She didn't mean to call him. She just happened to. So within 11 minutes of meeting her, they carried out this murder. Investigators started to think that this was a very well-organized murder carried out by people who had done this before. So back to your point, Elise, no evidence. These were not rookies. Police are also trying to figure out how the couple escaped so quickly with no one seeing them. Like I said, this was a pretty popular neighborhood. It was a little bit quiet, but there were still people out, including the witnesses. And Jason and his colleague were kind of driving around the area. Based upon what the witnesses saw, police think that the killers originally planned to leave through the front door, but saw Jason out there. So then they snuck around back, and that's why that back patio door was wide open. They didn't have time to shut it because they were kind of like, oh, someone's right there, like trying to get into this house. They knew their time was pretty short. Let's talk about this mysterious couple because they obviously are suspects at this point. Witnesses said the woman had short blonde hair and was very well dressed. She had a very distinctive dress that was black, white, and hot pink, and it looked to be a designer dress. There was very little information around the woman's, quote, husband.
I'm sorry I'm giggling, but whoever this eyewitness is catty as hell.
I'm picturing it to be a neighbor peeking out the window, like, who's moving into this house, right? I do that. If I see houses listed in our neighborhood, oh, I'm totally spying. Yeah.
No, I totally get it. It's just so funny. The dress appeared to be designer.
Appeared.
How does one know? a dresses designer from across the street, unless she's walking around with like a giant Gucci probably sign on her dress. Oh, I love like neighborhood gossip.
And this at this time it did pay off because they get this really descriptive kind of sighting of the couple. And the man with the woman was described to be white, 6 feet tall, and had dark hair. He was wearing a light colored jacket, not designer. That was never said. Law enforcement looked at Jennifer's phone records, and they discovered that the cell phone used by the unknown woman was purchased in Vancouver several months before the murder, and it had never been used until that initial call to Jennifer was made. It was, as we say, a burner phone. The phone was activated under the name of Paulo Rodriguez, and it was tied to a fake address. The phone was deactivated quickly after the murder. It has never been used since. Cell phone tower pings show the phone traveled on the ferry from Vancouver the day before the murder. Authorities believe the phone was used for the sole purpose of the murder and was discarded afterwards. This, once again, supports their theory that the murder was planned. The question now is, who would want Lindsay dead and why? There aren't a lot of suspects based upon no DNA, no physical evidence, that kind of thing, but two theories do emerge. The first theory has to do with Jason, the boyfriend, and his family. With any case, law enforcement is first going to look at the people closest to the victim. Before Lindsay was murdered, there was a lot of talk that Lindsay wanted to leave Jason. She was kind of over him, and he was turning a little bit possessive. So I can see how they make this possibility that he was there. His reaction after the murder was a little off. He wasn't super emotional. He wasn't really crying. But to that, I say we all share our emotions differently. You can't look at someone and go, he wasn't crying, he did it. I think that's kind of a stretch.
Grief is a weird thing that bothers me so much in cases. Like sometimes, of course, it turns out to be true that someone's acting kind of off. I'm thinking of
Chris Watts.
Chris Watts. Yeah, calling his girlfriend from the funeral right. And stuff. Yeah, that's some weird sus behavior, but just not shedding tears. Even myself, like I'm kind of trained to show up, show on, and then do that stuff privately. I don't know. I'm going on a tangent, but I hate when people make comments about, oh, they weren't crying, so that's suspicious.
Yep, agree 100%. I'm glad we're kind of on the same page for that because I feel like people do tend to place a blame or I would have been bawling. I would have been hysterical. Well, that's you. I'm an emotional person. My husband is not. I'll probably never see him cry. So we're all different. We all grieve differently. The other person in this family who was under a little bit of suspicion was Shirley, Jason's mother, who also was the manager at the RE/MAX office that Lindsay worked at. There was a lot of speculation that Shirley hired someone to kill Lindsay, but there is no motive and there's no real evidence that supports this theory. Some people say that she didn't like Lindsay and that she didn't like them being together, that she was a little bit intimidated by Lindsay's success. But to that, I say, I don't know. Once again, that kind of feels like a stretch.
That is some real mommy dearest vibes right there. If your mom is so involved with your love life that she hires a hitman, you all need some family counseling first and foremost. But I listened to another podcast and they kind of went down that route of maybe it was her. And of course, like, who knows? But that's a pretty new relationship. I'm not a mom, but unless there's something horrible going on, like maybe just sit and wait it out. Don't, you know, try to kill off the other lady in your son's
life. And I want to make it really clear here that Shirley and Jason have both been cleared of any and all involvement into the death of Lindsay. In fact, this past April, Shirley filed a civil lawsuit in the British Columbia Supreme Court alleging that she had been defamed by specific people. One of those being Lindsay's father, Jeff. I know Jeff has a good heart. He's trying to find out who killed his baby girl, but this is getting a little bit sticky. So I'm kind of going to step away from the assumption that they have anything to do with it just because of this lawsuit.
Yeah, let's not get sued. And this isn't even an allegedly situation. The police and law enforcement have already cleared her. But I totally understand in her line of work why you can't just have your name as a potential suspect. Could you imagine like, oh, my realtor might be a murderer, but, you know, I really want this house. I don't think anyone's having that conversation.
No, that's their livelihood too. And Jason was quoted as saying, we're not trying to stop Jeff, which is Lindsay's dad, from finding Lindsay's killers. We're just trying to stop these lies and people calling our family murderers when it's simply not true. So I totally get their stance on it, which opens up this other theory that I think is a little bit more credible. The Saanich police detectives reveal that in December of 2007, about 8 weeks prior to her murder, Lindsay was visiting her dad in Calgary. and while she was there, she tried to contact an old friend from high school. This friend happened to be a mid-level drug dealer with ties to a massive cocaine cartel. No one knows why Lindsay was calling this friend. He wasn't a good friend. It was kind of someone from her past. But her reaching out stumped a lot of investigators and the police. She reached out once via the phone and once via Facebook. It's undetermined if she ever made contact. Records just show she attempted. What's odd is the fact that according to her close friends and family, Lindsay didn't do drugs. She was really focused on growing her career and making a name for herself in the real estate world. So this call could have been completely random, but what happens next is pretty wild. During the time Lindsay was in Calgary visiting her dad, police were investigating and launching a huge investigation into the Calgary drug operations, and they were prepping for a big drug bust. They called this operation High Noon. The bust happened in late January 2008, and law enforcement seized a lot of cash and over 67 kilos of cocaine with a street value of $2 million.
Yeah, that's a big payday.
This actually turned out to be the largest drug bust in Alberta's history. And remember that old friend Lindsay was trying to contact? He was arrested as being a major participant in the illegal drug trafficking operation. It is speculated that Lindsay's murder may have been ordered by a drug cartel because she was believed to be a police informant.
Wait. She hasn't talked to this guy since high school.
But I'm going to get into a little more because I know right now it's kind of hard to picture, like, how are they connected? There was a detective who made a statement about the drug raid. He said people lost a lot of money and the people that lost the drugs know that someone spoke to the police. The ringleader of the drug cartel was not happy. There were a lot of rumors flying around that he wanted the person responsible to pay the consequences, and he wanted to make an example of them. So my thought is this. There's this pretty high-up guy in the drug cartel. Lindsay happens to make a phone call, happens to reach out on Facebook. My guess is they're trying to place the blame on anyone they can and make an example of them like he said he was going to. So did the leader think that Lindsay was the informant? Perhaps. Law enforcement has since come clean and said Lindsay was not the informant, but she could have been mistaken for it. Was she used as collateral damage? We don't know. To this day, this is a cold case, which is really sad. I talked about Jeff a little bit in the beginning. He does a great job about updating lindsaybuziakmurder.com. So for more information on this case, visit that website. He posts every news article release, and he just wants justice for his baby girl. The next case we're going to talk about happened in Arkansas, and it involves a realtor by the name of Beverly Carter. Beverly Carter was born on McClellan Air Force Base in Alabama in December of 1963. She married Carl Carter Sr., and together they had three children. Beverly loved traveling and spending time with her family, and she was a doting grandmother as well. At the time of her death, she worked as a real estate agent with Cree Leak Real Estate and was one of their top realtors. It was a crisp fall day on September 25th, 2014, and Beverly hopped in her car for a showing. She was going to show a couple a house on some property in Scott County, Arkansas. She called her husband, Carl, and let him know that she had one more showing at 5:30 p.m. and then she'd be home. She also gave Carl the address of the showing, so good for you, Beverly, for doing that because it comes back to really help her in the end. 5:30 comes and goes, 8:30 comes and passes, and it's now 9 o'clock when Carl starts to worry. He drove to the address Beverly gave him and finds her brown Cadillac sport utility vehicle parked in the driveway with her purse inside, and the door to the home that she was showing was standing wide open.
Oh, absolutely not. Can you imagine just the sheer panic?
It's 3 hours past her, you know, quote unquote, curfew, the time that she said she was going to be home. And I know he was panicking because I read some articles and it's really sad.
That's like three strikes. Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. You know, because you have the door open, which would already be terrifying. Her car alone wouldn't be so nerve-wracking, I would think. But then you add that her purse is in it. If I'm going to leave my purse in a car, I don't think I'm going to be out of that car for very long.
Exactly. Carl goes inside and starts to search for his wife, but he can't find her or any evidence in the house. He calls the police, lists Beverly as missing, and the search began the following morning. Investigators start to piece together Beverly's last known whereabouts, her movements, that kind of thing. But the most important thing they want to find is who did she meet up with to show this house to? They look through her phone records and find out that she had calls and texts to an unidentified number the day of the showing. That number was linked to TextMe, which is a company that assigns phone numbers and provides smartphone users with free text and voice messaging. Elise, your face is lighting up. Have you used TextMe?
No. No, I have not. I don't really understand the purpose. I guess maybe if you lost your phone and you need to use your computer or something. But my experience with this particular service has not been positive because if I remember correctly, it comes from a number that is not your own. It's not like I am iMessaging you and it still says my email address or my phone number if I was writing you from my computer. It's just like a generic message. So it can very quickly be used in a very abusive way. I'll just put it that way.
Exactly. I have used WhatsApp, which does the same thing. It gives you like a random phone number. You could text people overseas, that kind of thing.
But it's still tied to you.
Mm-hmm. So they assume that this number is connected to the client Beverly showed the house to. Law enforcement issues an extended circumstances request, and TextMe provides a report stating that the unidentified number on Beverly's phone is tied back to a man named Aaron Lowry, who lives in Jacksonville, Arkansas. Aaron Lowry was no stranger to law enforcement and has an extensive criminal history record, including a felony theft of property in the surrounding county. So this guy is kind of giving some red flags like, oh, this is the guy that she met up with. You know, I think there's probably some ding-dings going off in law enforcement's mind. On September 28, 2014, Lieutenant Mark Swaggerty conducted surveillance on Aaron's home. He observed Aaron get into a black Ford Fusion and drive away. Aaron and the vehicle matched a description of a person and a car seen at the house that was for sale when Beverly was present. Lieutenant Swaggerty followed Aaron for approximately 3 miles, and as Aaron was driving around a curve, he lost control of the vehicle and crashed into a ditch.
Annie, I really prepared myself there. I thought you were going to say, like, a body flew out of the trunk or something.
Something horrible. No, no, no. He crashed into a ditch and the lieutenant approached Aaron. Aaron was like, I need to go to the hospital. His face was all bloodied up. It didn't look good. Emergency personnel arrived and examined him. They put him inside the ambulance. And this is when Lieutenant Swaggerty puts on his game face. He asked for Aaron's telephone number. At this time, remember, they have that text me phone number. Aaron responded with a number that was one digit off from the number that was connected to the text messages received by Beverly via the TextMe app. So one digit off. The lieutenant asks again, sorry, can you repeat that number one more time? And this time he gives the exact phone number.
That's not a coincidence. There's too many possibilities there.
Mm-hmm.
The lieutenant seizes Aaron's phone as they're pulling up to the hospital. This next part's a little bit frustrating because Aaron goes into the hospital, gets patched up, and is supposed to be waiting for a CT scan. But instead, he walks out of the hospital because at this point, he's not arrested, but he definitely knows law enforcement is on to him. Luckily, Aaron's not the smartest thing. And the next day, he was arrested on one count of kidnapping in relation to the disappearance of Beverly Carter. The questioning begins, and during his 12-hour interrogation, he admits to kidnapping Beverly, but refuses to say where she was. Investigators have that phone that the lieutenant took, and they play a recording they found. This one's really sad. The recording is from Beverly, and they assume it was going to be sent to her husband, Carl. The recording says, Carl, it's Beverly. I just wanted to let you know I'm okay. I have not been hurt. Just do what he says, and please don't call the police. If you call the police, it could be bad. I just wanted you to know that I love you very much.
Oh my gosh, the amount of fear.
That's my thing. It's like she had so much fear. She knew something bad was happening. And I think that, in my honest opinion, makes it so much worse for any kind of case.
Absolutely.
Aaron was booked and taken into jail during this time. And investigators got a major break in the case that leads them to a concrete business in far northern Pulaski County where Aaron worked. So Aaron worked at this concrete plant. And this was about a half an hour drive from the home. Law enforcement obtains permission to search the property. And during the search, they find a very shallow grave toward the back of the property. Buried in the grave was Beverly Carter.
That's not the answer I was hoping for.
I know. They have a body. They have a suspect. But what investigators are stumped upon is the fact that Beverly told her colleagues she was showing the Scott County listing to a couple. A couple is two people.
Thank you for pointing that out. I've been out of one, so I'm glad you put that descriptor in there.
A couple is two. We have one. We need the other person. As it turns out, Aaron has a wife named Crystal, and investigators want to talk to her. They've booked her husband. Was she involved? They need to get some answers. Authorities meet up with Crystal, and they take her downtown for questioning. Crystal spills the beans and tells them everything they want to know. She wants to cooperate, which allows the authorities to make significant headway in this case. She goes on to tell the story from start to finish. She said that her and Aaron had devised a scheme where they planned to target a victim who was married, who worked alone, and who allegedly had a large net worth, around $100,000, and they were going to seek a ransom from the family. Aaron and Crystal found Beverly's Facebook page online, discovered that she was a real estate agent, and believed that she was a rich broker. They called Beverly, identified themselves as Crystal and Steve Adams, and asked Beverly to show them a home in the remote location. Posing as Steve Adams, Aaron met Beverly at the residence while Crystal went to work. Crystal said that while she was at work, Aaron texted her a picture of Beverly, who was bound with green duct tape in the trunk of his car. Crystal stated that Aaron planned to take Beverly to his place of employment, that concrete plant, but he didn't feel secure leaving her there. When Crystal came home, she learned that Aaron had locked Beverly in the bathroom of their bedroom, and Aaron explained to her that he had Beverly's debit card PIN, but that her purse and wallet were still at that Scott location, the house that she was showing them. Crystal was told to keep an eye on her while Aaron went back to the property to retrieve her purse. Aaron goes back to the property and there's cops everywhere. So he got nervous and he starts panicking. Beverly had seen his face, and in that bathroom where she was locked, Crystal had medications with her full name on it. So he immediately starts spiraling and tells Crystal, "She knows my face. She knows your full name. We have to get rid of her." According to Crystal, Aaron left with Beverly, killed her, and left her body near the concrete plant. The next morning, Crystal and Aaron purchased a shovel and buried her body in a shallow grave at the cement plant site. Beverly's cause of death was
asphyxiation.
Thank you. Asphyxiation due to an external airway obstruction from a duct tape mask on her face, which is horrible to me that she died that way.
I've never heard of that. I mean, obviously, I've heard of people having their mouth taped open, but not as the weapon to kill them.
I had never either. And I had to reread it a few times. Like, are we sure? But that's how she died. Both Crystal and Aaron were each charged with capital murder and the killing of Beverly. But Crystal pled guilty and she went on to trial actually to testify against Aaron. She received a 30-year sentence. And Aaron claimed his innocence, but he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for his involvement in the murder.
How do these scumbags find each other? There's like farmers only, and then there's like, hey, do you want to do horrible, horrible stuff and live the rest of our lives in jail over $100,000? Like, I'm sorry. Who gets to put a price tag on somebody else's life?
It's pitiful.
That's what I just don't understand. I haven't had enough time, like, meeting someone, even after being in a relationship and talking about your deepest, darkest secrets and maybe desires, mm-hmm. if you will. But could you imagine how you even broach this subject of, hey, by the way, I was thinking of doing a kidnapping. Is that something you'd be cool with?
It's so bad.
I have no words.
I know.
But I just don't know how these scumbags find each other.
Well, and how they found Beverly, which is so sad to me. They found her Facebook page. And it's like, as a realtor, you have to do that. You have to put your name out there. You have to. Networking is everything. So she was simply doing her job. And yeah, these scumbags did this to her. And she was a grandmother, a wife, a mom. Like, so, so, so sad. Our last case for today's episode happened in Cleveland, Ohio. Andrew Vonstein was an extremely successful realtor who had been in the real estate industry for over 30 years. His hard work had really paid off. He was one of the busiest and most successful real estate agents in Portage County, Ohio. Andrew wasn't your average real estate agent. He also held a broker's license and at one point owned his own real estate company. He also served as a buyer's agent and frequently showed homes listed by other realtors.
So if this was that Netflix show, he'd be Jason.
Which Netflix show?
Selling Sunset.
Oh!
He sells the homes, but he also owns the brokerage.
Exactly.
I know nothing about real estate whatsoever.
I forgot about Selling Sunset.
So that's what I'm comparing it to. Oh, okay. He is his own brokerage. Okay. So he's the Jason.
Yeah. That actually brings back the point of Selling Sunset. Those women probably have to have like security with them whenever they go to do their showings.
Oh, absolutely.
Andrew was dedicated to his work, but also to his family. He had a wife, Lauren, and two daughters. In September of 2010, him and Lauren decided to take a vacation and get a little R&R. They went to Georgia. And when he came back to work on Monday, his fellow realtor said that the vacation did him well. He was rested and relaxed, and he was coming home to an appointment right off the bat. He had a showing scheduled between 3:30 and 4:30 p.m. that day. Carol Foote was the listing agent for this specific property. If you're not familiar with real estate, a listing agent represents the seller. So she's kind of the one listing the house. She's talking to Andrew, giving him details around anything going on at the house, the address, the pricing, that kind of thing. The name of the client Andrew was working with was not disclosed to Carol nor to Andy's fellow realtors, which is actually not unusual. I called him Andy because a lot of the sources say that was his nickname. And, you know, you grow to like love these people during the research. So we'll call him Andy from now on. It's common practice to keep the name of the prospective buyer a secret until the offer is made. Andy tells his wife he'll be home soon and heads to the showing. Sadly, he never made it home. The next morning, his family reports him missing, and similar to the first two cases, investigators start tracing down Andy's last known whereabouts. His SUV had a tracking system, so law enforcement were able to track it down, and it brings them to this Twin Lake house that he was showing. Inside, they find his body, and he had been shot to death. Law enforcement start looking around the house and inside Andy's SUV, and they find a note that he had written. The note said, Robert Woodway, Monday, 4:30, and a phone number. Based upon that note, investigators were able to piece everything together. And the main thing that they pieced together was that cell phone number that he had written down. They had their eyes set on a 59-year-old man from Florida who actually had a past with Andrew. In fact, this 59-year-old was angry with Andrew due to a real estate deal that went sour.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me. So he's just sitting there plotting.
For years. For years, Elise, he was plotting this.
And then little Andrew's going on a family vacation and comes home to this bullshit. I mean, I'm very glad they took that trip. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, I'm sure that everyone in the family is because they got to have those memories together.
Yeah, let's talk about this timeline because, like I said, it was years in the making. Back in February of 2003, a couple by the name of Robert and Shirley Grigaitis, which is really hard to say, were living in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Shirley had a terminally ill son, and she wanted to move back to Ohio to take care of him. She cashes in her retirement and savings and heads to Ohio, where she finds Andrew Vonstein. The two decide to work together, and Andrew quickly finds her the perfect home close to her son. The deal goes smooth, except the land contract mentions a $40,000 existing mortgage on the property. Let me explain that a little bit better. So she's going to buy this house. It's perfect. In the fine print in the contract, it says, by the way, the mortgage on this is $40,000. It's never discussed who is going to pay this loan.
The loan is for the land that the house sits on.
That the previous owner named Richard Doak currently owns. Mm-hmm. Shirley buys the house and the land, and she moves in 3 weeks later. During this time, Robert, her husband, is still living in Florida. A few years later, in the fall of 2006, Shirley, who had been making monthly payments to Richard Doak, the owner, learns that her house, sold to her by Andrew, is in foreclosure because Richard Doak has failed to pay the mortgage.
So is she renting this home from the owner?
It was like a private buyer. Back in the day, if you don't take a loan out, you can pay that person directly, but he wasn't paying that mortgage and there's that existing loan.
So she's giving him money and this guy is just going to Sephora and buying all the new things and he's not putting it towards the bills that he should be paying.
Exactly. And I think that $40,000 loan is just like looming over his head because that's not getting paid either. So Shirley and Robert sue Richard Doak and they settle out of court because Richard signs a $60,000 promissory note, meaning he'll get everything paid up. It'll all be good. However, a few months later, he files for bankruptcy and that note becomes worthless. Go ahead. You have a question? Because I'm sure our listeners probably do too.
Okay. So I'm following all this. They sue him. He's like, sure, great. I'm going to settle with you. And then I'm going to file bankruptcy, which pretty much washes away any debt you have, except for, I think, like student loans mm-hmm. or something like that. And a couple other things. Now I'm starting to understand that level of anger because they didn't know about this money. Yes, the son might still be alive at this point, but you're going through a grieving process if you have mm-hmm. someone in your life that's terminally ill, which makes you a little wackadoodle.
Right.
And then you find out you owe all of this money that you weren't aware of when you just uprooted and like put all of your retirement into something. I could definitely, I mean, I'm not saying it's a reason to murder someone by any means, but I can understand how this is going to be a boiling point.
Exactly. And from that point forward, Robert blames Andrew, the realtor, for not helping them, but also Richard Doak, who sold them the house. And Robert began scheming this plan to take revenge on those that wronged him, those people being Andrew and Richard. Sadly, in 2008, Shirley ends up losing the home to foreclosure. And Robert tells a coworker that he was either going to get even with the real estate agent who wronged him, or he was going to kill him. Fast forward to September of 2010, when Robert reaches out to Andrew and he wants to work with him to buy a new home in Ohio. They do a few showings. Andrew does not recognize Robert because it's been 7 years since they last met. And Robert, in the meantime, is putting a plan into place.
7 years. I mean, I understand that, like, Richard Doak thing, again, not an excuse for murder, but that's some shady dealings. I don't know how real estate contracts work, but I can imagine that it might be a little bit of, like, a gray area, knowing what's owed on the land that the house sits on and stuff like that. I could see that that could be seen as misleading, but could honestly just be a mistake.
Right.
But it's the guy that wasn't using the money you were giving him to pay the mortgage is the real problem. But he's going after everyone. Wow.
Yes. So Robert makes his plan and he wants to lure Andrew and Richard Doak to a house and make them pay. Robert is working with Andrew in the meantime, getting a house set up, and he then goes to Richard's house. I know there's two R's. We're going to call Richard Doak just to make it a little bit easier. He goes to Doak's house and he's greeted by the in-laws. Robert tells the in-laws he wants to hire Doak for some remodeling work on a house in Twin Lakes. The mother-in-law gives Robert her son-in-law's number, but accidentally gives him the wrong number off by just one digit. Thankfully, Robert tries but fails to reach Doak, and he moves forward with his plan. So this is really just kind of fate that Doak never got that call.
The last case you covered got caught because of one missed phone number.
Isn't it crazy?
This guy is basically saved by one missed. That's really wild.
It is. On September 20th, Andrew and Robert meet up to do this final showing on this house. Between 5 and 5:30, a neighbor working in her yard hears a single pop from the direction of the Twin Lakes home. It was later revealed that investigators believe this is the gunshot that killed Andrew. Robert is now on the run from authorities who are frantically trying to track him down. Remember, they have his cell phone number on that notepad. They know he was the last person, and it's just too coincidental that he's just there, right? Like, they really want to talk to him because he's probably the person who last saw Andrew alive.
Well, and he has a motive.
Exactly. A big one. An angry one. A few weeks later, Robert calls his wife and tells her he is traveling from Ohio to North Carolina. He's at a rest stop and he admits to killing Andrew on the phone. He says, yeah, he's like, I did this. I'm traveling to North Carolina. I don't know what to do. She immediately turns him in. She's like, I don't want it to be any part of this.
Good job, Shirley. Are they still married at this time?
They're still married, but they've never really lived together. I think Shirley had a family from her previous life, one being the son who did pass away 3 weeks after she moved to Ohio, which made it even worse for her. But yeah, she's living in North Carolina, so he's kind of traveling there to go see her. He calls and says, I did this. She's like, mm-mm, I don't want a part of this. He calls law enforcement, who sends patrol cars to the rest stop. Inside of a restroom at that rest stop, Robert is washing his hands when a deputy marshal aims a red laser pointer from his taser gun at him. Robert is arrested without incident. He gives it up. He's like, yep, I did it. He admits to doing it. He pleads guilty to murder and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
This guy, he spent 7 years plotting this revenge. Where is his escape plan here? He's just driving around aimlessly being like, wife, I've got to call you and tell you what I did.
Yeah, I almost wonder if he was so focused on the murder, he didn't really think of the repercussions of, like, after what happens. Because driving from Ohio to North Carolina and just calling your wife and spilling the beans, I don't think he thought that out very well. Thankfully, for Andrew's sake, he didn't think it out very well.
Well, let's just make note. You spent 7 years plotting a revenge. I bet you anything, the minute that man pulled the trigger, and I'm not inside the mind of a killer, but probably didn't really give him the sense of closure that he wanted.
That's such a good point.
Like, he took two lives that day. He took his own and Andrew's. Mm-hmm. For what? For 40 grand. Oh, money.
Money is the root of all evil. We always say it. So all of this goes to show that every career, like I said, can be dangerous. I'm not trying to scare anyone from becoming a realtor or scare anyone who's currently a realtor, but more so just bring awareness. I looked up what the NAR, which is the National Association of Realtors, had on their website, and it is packed full of safety tips, safety videos, and even resources for personal protection. They have safety apps that you can download on your phone in case of an emergency, and they also have a few guidelines. A few that stood out to me include having an emergency exit strategy if needed during a showing, let's say you're in a showing, you're kind of panicking, you got to know where those doors are to quickly escape. It says, you know, run toward people if you can, like if you're not in a remote location. Another idea is to use your work address when sending work-related mail. Also use your work email. Never send anything from your personal cell phone number, email, or address. And the other tip was really get to know your prospective buyers before showing the house. Meet them in a public place for the first time. And if you ever are nervous, have a fellow realtor with you during showings. We're going to link that in our show notes. I really encourage, even if you're not a realtor, just to kind of go, because I think a lot of these tips apply to every job. Think about teachers, think about people in sales. I mean, the list is endless, but always just feel empowered when going to anything and make sure that you guys stay safe, because at the end of the day, that's the most important thing.
Right. It's like that little, the more you know, it's not going to hurt anything to look this over, because I guarantee there's 10 things that you're doing right, and then there's the one thing you aren't thinking of. So I'm glad that you pointed those out, because I'm sure all three people in these cases today thought they were just going about business as normal and would be returning to their loved ones. And like you said, it's not to scare you, it's more to empower you with information.
I know with one of our past episodes, audio is kind of off, and we are so thankful for everyone emailing us on Instagram saying like, hey, ladies, audio's off. We are so fortunate to be able to do this podcast, and we love seeing the positive feedback, and the messages on Instagram always warm my heart, even though I think most people think I'm Elise. I'm like, it's actually Annie.
Really?
Yeah. So I was like, Elise, I love this. And I'm like, I just ask like, I'm like, awesome, thanks.
Oh, Annie the impersonator. Okay.
I'm impersonating you. But in all seriousness, we do love you guys. Thank you for the patience while we kind of get this podcast worked up. I've never done a podcast before. I know a lot of people probably are like, yeah, it shows,
no.
But I'm getting more comfortable. And Elise, you're such a great like co-host, and you know, you're teaching me all the things like how to set my microphone upright, which if you listen to the first couple episodes, you're like, oh, sounds like Annie needs an audio adjustment, but we're getting there, and we're just thankful for everyone for hanging in with us.
Yeah, that is a massive understatement. I think both of us kind of sat down when we thought about doing this podcast and strategizing not just the business end of it, but just the community that we wanted to create. And so far, you know, constructive criticism, like you said with the last episode, we need to know that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we welcome it. But the response overall has been really overwhelmingly positive, and I appreciate it. You know, I've talked about love life and things like that on podcasts as a guest, but I certainly haven't dove into doing my own. And you and I are becoming friends through this podcast. We need to talk about that sometime, of how this all kind of really came together. So this has been a journey, and we're only a couple of months in. So things will get better as we dive in and know more about this podcasting world, but we're just really appreciative of all the support thus far. With that said, I have an ask. Like I said, it was my birthday not so long ago. So if you guys want to do the biggest birthday gift ever, you can go to Apple. Whatever you're listening, look down at your phone right now, unless you're in a car, look down at your phone. Whatever you're listening to this episode on, click the follow, click the like. If it's Apple Podcasts, please take the time to write a review. We don't need you to sugarcoat things. If there's things that you think that we can improve on, we want to know. But it really, really does help us grow this podcast so that we can spend more time and energy into the production of it and research. And we would really appreciate that, especially me. And yes, I am guilt tripping you with my birthday. So right now, go ahead and do it. Thank you very much.
give the Leo what she wants, people.
I know. That was a very Leo thing of me to say. Like, now to turn the attention back at me and my birthday, we're going to start the episode with that. We're going to end the episode with that.
I love it.
Anyway, as always, we will be back next Sunday, or maybe a little sooner. Who knows? And until then.